Protests in Wisconsin continue after the police shooting of Jacob Blake.
I'm not sad. I'm angry.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, August 26th, a look at the long-standing tensions between communities of color and police in Wisconsin amid the shooting. Then we break down last week's Senate intelligence report on Russian interference in the 2016 election.
The head of Donald Trump's campaign had a close and ongoing business relationship with a Russian intelligence officer named Konstantin Kalimnik.
And how suicide is still poorly understood, even among mental health professionals. And we round out the show with another look at Fort Hood and the case of Elder Fernandez, who's missing weeks after Vanessa Guillen was killed. So let's get started.
I am my brother's keeper. And when you say the name Jacob Blake, make sure you say father, make sure you say cousin, make sure you say son, make sure you say uncle, but most importantly, make sure you say human. Human life. Let it marinate in your mouth, in your minds. A human life. Just like every single one of y'all and everywhere around the world, we're human. And his life matters.
That's Letitra Weidman. Her brother Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old unarmed black man, was shot multiple times in the back by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin on Sunday. According to the family's attorney, Blake is alive and still in the hospital, but is now paralyzed from the waist down. Blake's shooting underscores long-standing tensions in the state between communities of color and police. Jacob Blake's father spoke at a press conference yesterday.
Anybody that is white that is doing an investigation about a black young man that was shot 7 times in his back and haven't come up with an answer or a comment at this point is not welcome.
Last night was the third night of protests in Wisconsin, which turned deadly after a man shot and killed 2 protesters and injured 1 other. And Wisconsin is also one of the worst states for black Americans to live, so much so that it recently became one of 3 states and dozens of cities and counties in the U.S. that declared racism a public health crisis.
This is nothing new. I'm not sad. I'm not sorry. I'm angry. And I'm tired. I haven't cried 1 time. I am numb. I have been watching police murder people that look like me for years.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and we start in Wisconsin today on The Takeaway. Joining me now is Mark Levine, the director of the Center for Economic Development at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanzina. It's good to be with you.
Lots happening on the ground in your state right now. Let's zoom out for a moment. Kenosha is right outside of Milwaukee. You've been researching the history and the policy behind racial disparities in the state, and you called Milwaukee the epitome of a 21st century racial regime. It's a heavy thing to say. Tell me why, how you got to that conclusion, Mark.
So I think I describe Milwaukee as the epitome of 21st century racial inequality after looking at this array of indicators that shows how Milwaukee ranks either worst or next to worst or certainly in the bottom 5 on virtually all indicators of black well-being in the nation's largest metropolitan areas. It's the most segregated, has the highest black poverty rate, the greatest gap in black-white income, lowest black household income, third highest incarceration rate, and so forth. And so I thought of that in the context of Dr. King in the 1960s, in 1963 to be exact, in his letter from a Birmingham jail, talking about why he was in Birmingham, that Birmingham was the epitome of 20th century racial segregation, legally established apartheid that mandated essentially by law racial inequality. Well, it's different today. We certainly have policies that are discriminatory, have institutional arrangements that are discriminatory, but we don't have laws that per se prescribe racial inequality, but nonetheless, as a consequence of those policies and institutional arrangements, we have a level of racial inequality in Milwaukee today that rivals or even exceeds the racial inequality that existed in Birmingham in the 1960s. So given Milwaukee's poor standing on all of these indicators, worse even than places that are also pretty distressing, like Chicago and like Buffalo and like Detroit and like Cleveland. Given Milwaukee's standing, I thought it would be appropriate to call Milwaukee, in the way that Birmingham was in an earlier era, the epitome of racial inequality in urban America today.
We're now also joined by James Causey, who's a project reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. James, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
James, you grew up in Milwaukee. What's it like for Black communities there as you listen to Mark's findings here? And tell us how, you know, that experience was.
Well, Mark's findings for me being an African-American, is not really very surprising. One thing that I noticed as a Black man growing up here and living here for more than 50 years is that, you know, we have a lot of problems here. When we lost our manufacturing base, my father and mother both worked in manufacturing and worked on assembly lines. When we lost those jobs, there was nothing set to replace them. So Milwaukee never really established a middle class, a strong Black middle class. The middle class lasted for a short period of time, and it was like, you know, that short time window was there. And when the manufacturing jobs either moved south or they moved their jobs to the suburbs or closed altogether, I mean, Black people were left here back in Milwaukee with nowhere to get out to the jobs because the transportation didn't get us out to the where the factories were. And when, you know, one pastor told me that Milwaukee is like on an island. Like, so all the Black people live in Milwaukee, and once you leave Milwaukee and try to go to, you know, one of the suburbs in Milwaukee, it's like, why did you leave the plantation? You feel like you're out of place. You know, you're picked on by police. You may get stopped. You may be looked at funny, and those kind of things happen. And because of that, because of those reasons, I think a lot of people feel that the segregation is always on top of us. The racism is always on top of us. And so when we have incidents like this shooting that took place in Kenosha, it's just another eye-opening experience for a lot of us.
James, can you give us a sense of what's happening on the ground right now in light of the protests now have been going on for about 3 days? There were some peaceful protests, and then there was an incident where protesters were shot. What do we know so far about that?
Well, what we know is at least two people were killed last night. One other person was injured in a shooting. There's video that was shot by people with camera phones, and it looked like a man was being jumped in the middle of the street, and he came up with a gun, and he just started firing, and he shot two people. It was a violent night last night. A lot of cars were vandalized. A lot of buildings were burned. A lot of property damage, and I don't see any end in sight for this unless more troops are probably called in and stricter curfews are put in place. I think right now a lot of people are just frustrated, and you have peaceful protesters, but at the same time you have a lot of people just coming in because they're agitators, and they're coming in to just create all kinds of mayhem and things like that. And sometimes that could blur the message. The message should be that people should not be shot seven times in the back and paralyzed, and especially a father of six, when a lot of people look at this and they by looking at the video, you would come to the conclusion that maybe something else could have been done to stop it from escalating to that point.
Mark, when you look at what's happening, is there, particularly the shooting that we're talking about with Mr. Blake, are you surprised by the reaction? Does this essentially buttress what you've seen in terms of your research and how the relationship between Black people who live in the state of Wisconsin and police generally unfold?
I think the levels of racial inequality and the level of estrangement in the black community, between the black community and the police department in cities like Milwaukee and Kenosha, are so entrenched and so pervasive that any kind of incident, and this is more than just any kind of incident, this is the most horrific and heartbreaking kind of incident, can be a catalyst for an outburst. I mean, I think we're really now at the point after a generation, and let's be honest, conditions have deteriorated for the black community in places like Kenosha and in Milwaukee for 40 and 50 years. And I think we're at the point where that decline and that inequality has become such a part of daily life, as James was mentioning, that any kind of event can I think produce this kind of explosion. I mean, when you look at a community like Kenosha, you know, in which 40% of working age black males are not employed, in which 33% of the black population lives below the poverty line, and in which the black community has actually a higher incarceration rate than the black community in Milwaukee, which is notorious for being one of the centers of mass incarceration in the country. I mean, you can see how all of the pent up anger was there in Kenosha, ready to explode.
James, a lot of these uprisings against police brutality that we're seeing are now starting to sort of fit a pattern that I witnessed when I covered the shooting and killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, where protesters rightfully speak out against the injustice, and leadership calls in, you know, the National Guard at this point, and this is almost becoming part of the playbook. How's Milwaukee's leadership trying to address some of the issues that they're seeing unfold after the shooting of Mr. Blake?
Well, you know, it's funny how you say it follows a pattern. It follows a pattern because nothing has changed. I mean, we go through this it used to be every couple of years. Now it's seems like it's every month that where we come across something like this. People say we have to come together. You know, you bring in the National Guard, you have the looting, you have the arguments. People say that we have to do better. People say we have to come together, but then nothing really changes. And the reason that we keep having these same talks and these same exhausting conversations is because nothing ever changes. This is going to be a pattern that continues. Nobody is really talking about what we need to do to fix this. I mean, I think we need very specific things. The black community needs to ask for very specific things of what we need to change the conditions that we constantly face. One thing, you know, that's been talked about is no knee to the neck, you know, and no more chokeholds and things like that. But I think we need to even go a step further. You know, like in our schools in the inner cities, our schools should be funded at better than a rate than the schools in the suburbs. I mean, we need to have the best teachers in our schools in our inner cities. We need to have the best possible resources for our kids in our inner cities. We need to make sure that families are safe and not being evicted and thrown out on the street. We need to make sure that jobs are livable wage jobs are out there. We need to raise the minimum wage. We need to ask for things like this, or else none of this stuff will ever change. And there needs to be better community police relationships, because honestly, these things happen and nothing ever changes between the relationships between the police and the citizens.
So, Mark, at the Republican National Convention this week, one of the themes has been the, quote, invasion of the suburbs. And I'm wondering, what role does that framing play in the suburbs in Wisconsin and potentially around the country in creating even more racial disparities?
That's historically been a very potent issue in Wisconsin, particularly southeastern Wisconsin, Milwaukee through Racine and Kenosha. All of those metropolitan areas are intensely segregated in a metro area setting, so that you've got in Milwaukee and in Kenosha over 90% of the black population in the metro area lives in the city itself, or put another way, only 10% of the black population lives in the suburbs. It's the lowest level of black suburbanization in the country. I mean, there has been a substantial amount of black suburbanization, even in highly segregated cities like Detroit or Baltimore or Cleveland, where upwards to 40 to 50% of the metro area's black population has moved to the suburbs. Not so in Milwaukee. Milwaukee, in some ways, resembles almost this 1960s, 1970s model of kind of an iron collar around the city. And outside of that collar is essentially a homogeneous white suburb. And there's been strong resistance in the suburbs in Milwaukee to anything that smacks of desegregation, opposition to affordable housing. There was in Milwaukee for a period a modest voluntary school desegregation plan at the metro area level, but it was modest, and there was certainly not area-wide school desegregation. There's still, I think, a general resistance in Milwaukee suburbs to desegregation in housing. Real estate patterns, or I should say lending patterns in the suburbs. There's been analysis of mortgages showing sort of discriminatory patterns of mortgage lending. So, you know, I think there is, and certainly politically, it's been a potent, more racially coded, I would say, than as overt as it's been at the Republican National Convention, where it's any racial coding has certainly been dropped. But where, you know, political candidates trying to gain the suburban vote in the Milwaukee area will talk about, you know, the Milwaukee problems and talk about Milwaukee in the way that Milwaukee almost becomes a proxy word for race. So I think it has been a potent issue. I suspect we've seen a little bit in voting behavior over the last maybe 4 or 6 years. A bit of an attenuation of that. The Republican vote, for example, has declined a little bit in some of those strongholds. So I think the issue will resonate in some communities, but perhaps less than even, you know, a decade ago or certainly several decades ago. But it's still a very real political issue here. Racialized politics are certainly alive and well here.
Milwaukee is a critical state, as you know, Mark, in the presidential election. I mean, it's we're not very far away from that. We're about 3 months away, or less than 3 months away, from the 2020 presidential election. The Takeaway is now on air across the state, and I'm wondering, given everything that we just talked about, do you suspect that this might tip the scales, or it's still too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell, but you know, there are certainly any number of potential impacts of what's happening now and what, you know, certainly could be happening throughout the fall, because certainly we've had, you know, 2 months now of mobilization over Black Lives Matter, and now this episode in Kenosha, which I think takes things to a new level. So it's certainly possible that with racial violence, or seeming to have racial violence in Kenosha, that there could be some portion of a Republican electorate in the suburbs that has been ready to desert the Trump candidacy for all number of reasons, to say, well, wait a second, I'm still not ready to go over to the Democrats and kind of revert to traditional Republican kind of resistance to on issues of race and desegregation. But it's unclear. I mean, for example, if the incident that occurred last night in Kenosha turns out to be a vigilante shooting by white nationalists, is there a revulsion against that in affluent suburbs where persons, I think, don't perceive themselves as being overtly racist and view these events, you know, with obviously a great deal of empathy and distaste, as they did obviously in the case of the murder of George Floyd, where there was certainly a reaction across the board to that. So I think it's too early to tell. We'll have to see how things unfold. But it's very clear that Wisconsin, you know, at this point has a very slight edge for the Democrats in polling. But it's far from a given which direction the state's going to go in November.
James Causey is a project reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Mark Levine is the director of the Center for Economic Development at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Human life. Let it marinate in your mouth, in your minds. A human life. just like every single one of y'all and everywhere around us. We're human. And his life matters.
Blink and you may have missed it. Last week, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a nearly 1,000-page report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. The document laid out in new detail links between the Trump campaign and Russia, often going beyond what Robert Mueller had revealed in his report last spring. For more on what we learned, we're turning to my colleague Andrea Bernstein. She's the co-host of Trump Inc., a podcast from WNYC and ProPublica. She's also the author of American Oligarchs, coming out in paperback October 6th. Andrea, so good to talk to you.
It's so good to talk to you, Tanzina.
So remember the Senate Intelligence Committee in this report? This actually draws a line between the Mueller investigation and the impeachment hearings, from what we understand. Tell us how they did that.
Yeah, so, I mean, this report, which I have been immersed in many of its 966 pages with copious thousands of footnotes, all of which are worth reading. I've been immersed in it for the past week. And it's a really an extraordinary document for its level of detail, but also because it was endorsed by a bipartisan committee, which makes it unique among all of the different kinds of investigations that we've had of what happened in the 2020 election. And what's so interesting about this report is because it is untethered from what the Mueller report was tied to, which is to say, namely, was there a crime committed? It lays out a very concerning narrative of what happened in 2016 and also how the disinformation and the cover-up continues to this day.
In the report, we learn more about a man that you and I have talked about in the past, Konstantin Kilimnik, and his dealings with Paul Manafort, remember that name, who was President Trump's former campaign chairman, who was convicted in the Mueller probe. What did we learn about Kilimnik?
It is really extraordinary because as I read this report and live the reality of the 2020 convention, I think back to 2016 when Paul Manafort was in charge of it for the Republican Party. He was in charge of the messaging. He was in charge of rounding up the delegates for then nominee Donald Trump. And we saw what was having we saw what was happening on the surface, and we were sort of interpreting it in real time. But what we see in this report was what was happening under the surface. And that was that Paul Manafort, the head of Donald Trump's campaign, had a close and ongoing business relationship with a Russian intelligence officer named Konstantin Kilimnik. And that Konstantin Kilimnik had experience in election interference over more than a decade, working with oligarchs and others very close to the Kremlin. That's what was going on. And that's what we learned 4 years ago, almost exactly today, when President Trump, or then just candidate Donald Trump, was trying to achieve the presidency.
There are also questions in the report about how forthcoming President Trump was with Robert Mueller, the former special counsel. What did that determine? Did the president lie to Robert Mueller?
Well, the report pretty clearly shows how he did. I mean, in a criminal defense, you have wide latitude with saying, I don't recall. However, if this were a prosecution, which as I said, it's not, you could weigh the number of contacts and the volume of information versus somebody's non-recollection. What happens in this report is that the report shows that there were hundreds of contacts between Roger Stone and top Trump campaign aides. And there were also direct contacts with Donald Trump. And what were they talking about? They were talking about when WikiLeaks would release its tranche of stolen documents, of documents that it had stolen from the DNC. President Trump, as laid out in the report, would frequently use his security guard's phone to hide from people that he was speaking to Roger Stone. So the report really lays out as non-criminal credible what Trump told Mueller in a sworn statement, which was that he did not recall any conversations with Roger Stone, and he didn't recall any specific conversations between June and November of 2016, when we see clearly from this report is bolstered by witness testimony, phone records, that there were many, many contacts between Roger Stone and Donald Trump during this time about specifically the documents that the Russians had stolen.
The reporter also mentions Ivanka Trump's efforts, or at least contact with the documents that were being released by WikiLeaks. What do we know about her relationship there with those documents?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. And one of the things that you can really see in the report is how the Russians were so well organized. They had so many ways that they were trying to get their hooks into the Trump campaign. One of which was the vector through Paul Manafort, who obviously led the campaign for a while. And there is this concerted campaign to get Manafort into his position in the campaign. And part of it goes by lobbying Ivanka. And Ivanka is convinced. And she sends an email to her father that says, "Daddy, Tom says we should get Paul." Tom is Tom Barrack, a financier and a friend of the Trumps. So it shows how the sort of Manafort-Kalimnik side was very, very, very deliberate in what they were doing. And then they reached this family business and just kind of walk right in. We also see how later in the campaign, even after it became clear, even after it was public, when U.S. Intelligence agencies said these documents were stolen by Russia, Ivanka Trump directed the senior campaign aides to send two tweets a day about the WikiLeaks content. Now, what they have said, what especially Ivanka Trump's Jared Kushner has said, is that these documents were in the public realm, and they were merely pointing people to things that were in the public realm. And the report really raises a question of, here were stolen materials used by someone who wants to be the president of the United States. That is something that is highly questionable. And they go even further. They say that their actions in an entirety, the Trump campaign's actions in their entirety, were a grave counterintelligence risk.
This was questionable activity by the president. Was it illegal?
The Justice Department has made the determination that a sitting president cannot be prosecuted. So that's why Mueller did not charge Trump with any crimes. You are not allowed to lie to federal investigators. And if the Justice Department were pursuing this as a crime, it would weigh the idea of, did President Trump lie to federal investigators? And in fact, Roger Stone himself was indicted and convicted of lying to investigators and lying to Congress. That was before his sentence was commuted by President Trump. So that is a very serious charge. There's also something else that is just threaded through this report is all of the ways that Trump and his campaign tried to hide their contacts. I mentioned the use of his security guard's phone. We also saw that Paul Manafort, his campaign manager, Rick Gates, his deputy campaign manager, Roger Stone, and many others used encrypted apps which destroyed and obscured their conversations. If this were a criminal prosecution, you could use this kind of behavior as something that's known as consciousness of guilt. And consciousness of guilt can, in fact, be evidence of guilt. So, I mean, we're all speaking hypothetically at this point because the Justice Department has made quite clear it is not going to charge President Trump with any crimes. But there is certainly plenty of cover-up which leaps out of these 966 pages. And what's so extraordinary is that Republicans who have otherwise sort of publicly dismissed the findings and say it didn't find collusion have in fact endorsed this report, which if you just read the words on the page suggests something entirely different.
Andrea, we are less than 80 days away from the 2020 election. What does this report and other previous reports from the Senate Intelligence Committee really tell us about the potential for our 2020 election to have Russian interference?
Well, I think it is pretty clear that, that these things are ongoing, and we know they're ongoing because we can see them in plain sight. One of the things that the report lays out is how the counter-narrative to the Russia investigation, which is that this was a hoax, which was it was really Ukraine that interfered in the election, is that that narrative came directly from the Kremlin. And that is laid out in the report, how it came from the Kremlin, it came from Paul Manafort, that part of this active measures attack on America was creating the seeds of a narrative that would reject it. And we have seen that this week in the Republican convention. We saw Jim Jordan, Representative Jim Jordan, on Monday night referring to the Russia hoax. And if you read through this report carefully, you can see that the bipartisan Senate committee rejects that this was a hoax. And they say, in fact, the line that it was a hoax, the idea that it was a hoax, the idea that it maybe started in Ukraine, that it didn't really happen, that originated from the Kremlin. So not only did they create this campaign of influence, but they created a situation where trying to investigate it would prod a narrative that also came from the Kremlin. And I think that is so extraordinary because we are living through it.
Andrea Bernstein is the co-host of Trump Inc., a podcast from WNYC and ProPublica, and she's also the author of American Oligarchs, which will be out in paperback October 6th. Andrea, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tanzina. Great to be able to talk to you about this.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And just a note to our listeners, this next segment discusses suicide and suicidal thoughts. People thinking about suicide are often encouraged to seek out some kind of professional help, but many mental health professionals have little formal training in suicide prevention. There are currently no national standards requiring mental health professionals to be trained in treating suicidal patients, and only a handful of states mandate this kind of training. And while we've gotten better at talking about things like depression and anxiety, suicidality is still poorly misunderstood and treated, even as the rate of suicide is rising in the United States. The latest available data from the CDC estimates that more than 48,000 people died by suicide in 2018. With the pandemic still ongoing, concerns about mental health are in the spotlight.
We don't have good evidence yet of what the results of this pandemic are in terms of suicide. We do know there's an increase in suicidal thoughts, and we also know that some places are reporting an increase in calls to hotlines, but we don't know about actual suicides yet.
Stacy Friedenthal is a psychotherapist and associate professor at the University of Denver Graduate School of Social Work and author of the book Helping the Suicidal Person. And for more on this, I spoke with Stacy and Kelechi Ubozo, a mental health consultant, suicide attempt survivor, and author of We've Been Too Patient, Voices from Radical Mental Health. And here's what Kelechi told me about how suicide is thought of by some in the mental health community today.
Mental health is still a struggle for folks because there's still this idea that you're someone who is mentally ill or you're mentally healthy. But everyone has mental health. And the way that we experience it, the way that it shows up, our struggles are different. But there's not someone who doesn't have mental health, as we're finding out with this pandemic. And the way that suicide is treated, or even I've been treated by disclosing in different spaces that I thought were safe around being a suicide attempt survivor, there's been a lot of fear, there's been a lot of judgment, which does not help people who have suicidal thoughts, and isolation is something that impacts us a lot. So I would say it's still very much stigmatized, unfortunately.
How do you explain the lack of training here?
There's myriad reasons why I think it's present. One is, as Kelechi was saying, there's stigma, and there's stigma among mental health professionals. And there are many mental health professionals who resist working with suicidal clients. And that can be present among faculty and developers of programs, that they're not placing the right emphasis and importance on this really pressing problem.
Kelechi, you yourself are a suicide attempt survivor. When you attempted to get help, how were you treated? What was your experience like?
I attempted 11 years ago, and one of the things that happened to me is that I'm a Black woman, and the way that I was treated when I needed support was abysmal. I present well, so a judgment that can happen depending on who you are, your culture, how you look when you need help. People didn't take me seriously. So I actually went to get suicide prevention because I was having thoughts of harm, and they turned me away, and I had to go back to the same hospital because I attempted. So I was trying to actually get support to go inside the hospital, but I looked too well for them. They didn't take me seriously. So they were like, no, we can't see you. So I had to come back when I attempted. And then when I was in the actual hospital, I mean, it was like adult daycare. We weren't really getting any treatment and we were watching movies. The thing I like to tell people was the minute I knew that the system was the problem was all of these, you know, folks who have attempted or are struggling were sitting watching Silence of the Lambs in a psych ward. And you cannot make that up. Part of me wanted to laugh because it was so ridiculous. And the other part of me was like, if this is treatment, how do people get better? And that's my story and that's my experience. And that was a really unfortunate experience. That's not everyone's experience. But if that is the treatment, the next thing I would do is never go back. I would never tell anyone when I'm struggling again because the treatment was so traumatic.
I have to say, Kelechi, what you're describing, I think, is something I actually had written this down. Do people take it seriously before you shared that? And I wonder if that's something that happens, particularly, as you said, with women who are professional, with women who present well, with women who, you know, are people are women of color, in particular, Black and brown women, whether or not people do take us seriously. Stacey, what is the gap there? I mean, if somebody comes in and says, I am experiencing thoughts of harming myself, how could someone not take that seriously?
People operate at extremes, and you've got at one extreme the professionals who didn't take Kelechi seriously and don't take others seriously. But then at the other extreme, you've got professionals who, you know, for lack of a better phrase, freak out. You know, and they hear the word suicide and they immediately think, oh my God, I've got to get this person to an emergency room. I've got to call 911. When really what the person needs is to be able to tell their story and to be heard and listened to.
I wanted to add to what Stacey said. That has been a lot of people's experience, especially in communities of color or in the trans community who have, you know, a really difficult and challenging history with law enforcement. Law enforcement shouldn't be the first responder to a mental health crisis. And a lot of folks get really scared when you start talking about suicide. So if we were able to normalize the conversation that talking about suicide does not cause it, and that some folks are, when they're asking for help, it might be, I need to have you listen. I need to just have you stay with me while I'm crying. It doesn't mean I need you to take me away. Really, the challenge is, how are we treating people when they're disclosing or sharing? And if we judge them, or if we say that they're broken, or if we try to, you know, basically isolate them, then how are they going to be truthful the next time this happens?
Stacey, you have had firsthand experience trying to get help with your own suicidality. How has that informed your work?
Oh, it's completely informed it. And again, Kelechi, my experience was on the other end of the spectrum of yours. And that's that when I first went for help for suicidal thoughts in my 20s, I was terrified that I would be hospitalized against my will just for mentioning the word. And so I kind of tested out the therapist and I said, I'm thinking of doing something drastic just to kind of feel out his reaction. And he got visibly uncomfortable and it stressed me out. And so I backpedaled and he said, what do you mean something drastic? And I said, quit my job. And then he was visibly relieved. I tried somebody else so that I could speak honestly about what I was experiencing. And he first tried to get me to promise not to do anything to hurt myself, which if only it were that easy. But then when I couldn't make that promise, he recommended hospitalization. So it was my fears come true.
This is a pandemic that has imposed isolation on people. It has imposed, as a result of that isolation, a lot of loneliness, which was already a problem in this country. How do we get through this for people who are experiencing suicidal ideation right now?
I can only share what has been helpful for me as a Black woman and what has been helpful for some of the folks around me. But I think one of the things is actually doing crisis planning. So you could do this as Wellness Recovery Action Plan, which is called a WRAP, but really thinking about what are the things that come up when you're struggling and what are the things that will help mitigate that. And really thinking about if something really bad happens, right? If you're having lots of harmful thoughts and you really, really need support, who is on your team, right? Who can help you go to a crisis center? Do you have a therapist that you can call? Is there a friend or family member that you want involved in this? And if you're a friend or family member, trying to understand what are the resources and what are your boundaries? Because not everyone is going to be able to sit with someone when they're struggling, but you can point them to resources. And, you know, we do have the National Prevention Suicide Hotline, and they do help people who are friends of family who might need more support understanding folks. It's not the perfect answer, but I think interrupting isolation is probably one of the biggest things. So how do you interrupt isolation? And then how do you connect to resources you want? Another thing is if there are lethal means nearby, and there's something you're worried about in your house and that's been on your mind, is there someone you can connect to remove them from your house? You know, all things considered with safety, because I think that's one thing to also consider.
Stacey, what do we know about which suicide prevention approaches work best? Which ones are most effective?
The one thing we know that can prevent suicide is connection. And there was a study, it was a very, very simple study, where people who were discharged from a hospital for suicidal thoughts, half of them received postcards just saying, basically, we're thinking of you and hoping you're doing well, not even asking for a response. And the other half did not receive those cards. And the half that received the cards had lower suicide rates in the years to come. What a simple intervention, you know, to let people know that they're being thought about and cared for. There are also therapies that have evidence of effectiveness, you know, not with everybody, but more so than no treatment at all or just standard treatment. And those are things like cognitive behavior therapy, dialectical behavior therapy. And there's something called the Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicidality, which is commonly called CAMS. So there are treatments, you know, that have evidence that they can reduce suicide attempts, other suicidal behaviors and thoughts in the people who receive them.
Kelechi, I'd love to close with your thoughts on that, because one of the things we've been talking about on The Takeaway as well is how people are attempting to find joy in this moment. But I think this is a conversation, and I'm starting to turn that around to talking about hope. Where are you seeing rays of hope?
Even though people are struggling in a way that we haven't seen before, I have never been asked so many times to connect with people around mental health. I have been trying to bring awareness around this topic, around suicide, and people are listening. Their hearts are open because they're experiencing it. They're understanding what isolation means for them. And I think that does open up our understanding. And sometimes pain and loss actually opens us up to have more connection with one another. When I think about this right now, when I think about the pandemic and when I think about suicide, I think because people are open to having these conversations, they might be open to receiving support and open to being part of that connection and that force.
Kelechi Ubozo is a mental health consultant and author of We've Been Too Patient, Voices from Radical Mental Health. And Stacey Friedenthal is a psychotherapist and author of the book Helping the Suicidal Person. Kelechi, Stacey, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experiences with me.
Thank you very much, too.
If you or someone you know is having suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Or text HOME to the crisis text line at 741-741.
The Fort Hood military base in Texas is making headlines again for yet another missing person in a string of incidents. 23-year-old Sergeant Elder Fernandez has been missing since August 17th. A spokesperson from Fort Hood said Fernandez had recently been transferred after being the victim of abusive sexual contact. Fernandez's disappearance comes on the heels of the death of Army Specialist Vanessa Guillen, whose remains were identified in July after having been reported missing from Fort Hood for more than 2 months. Before she disappeared, Guillen had told friends that she had been sexually harassed on the base. Guillen's death and now the disappearance of Fernandez have sparked a larger conversation on the mishandling of sexual assault on military bases and has led to multiple investigations into conduct at Fort Hood. Joining me now is Nicole Acevedo, digital reporter for NBC News, who's been following the story. Nicole, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about the sexual abuse that Sergeant Fernandez said he experienced at Fort Hood?
Yeah, I mean, what officials at the Army have told us is that he had recently been transferred to a different unit because he was the victim in an open investigation looking into what they were calling abusive sexual contact. And, you know, the fact that it is an open investigation, it's a little bit different from what we saw with Vanessa Guillen's case, where we saw the family say, listen, our daughter, our sister expressed that she was harassed at this base, but then officials said that nothing was open, no investigation was open within their unit, and no officials were sort of acknowledging that. So with Fernandez's case, that's a little bit different, the fact that the Army is involved and that he was transferred from a different unit. The reason for that was to prevent any sort of backlash or conflicts that might affect Elder in the middle of that investigation that's still ongoing.
Nicole, in a statement, the Army said that they do not suspect foul play and believe that Sergeant Fernandez left on his own accord. What proof do they have of that?
I mean, right now, things are looking complicated for the Army's statement. The family, the Fernandez family, is being represented by attorney Natalie Kawan. If the name rings a bell, it's because it's the same attorney that represented the Guillen family in their case. She tweeted overnight that a body was found in Temple, Texas, and they suspect that it might be Elder Fernandez's body, and that the body has been there for quite some time. The Army has not said anything publicly yet about this finding, but then, you know, the fact that last week they said that they did not suspect that foul play may seem a little bit conflicting.
Nicole, you've spoken to Sergeant Fernandez's mother. What did she have to say about what happened and about the Army's response to her son's disappearance?
His mother, Ileana Fernandez, we spoke briefly on Friday. She had traveled from Massachusetts, where she lives, to Texas to get some answers. We spoke Friday. Elder had been missing since Monday, and I was telling her how was she feeling, and what she told me right then was, as of right now, I'm not getting any answers. We spoke briefly on Tuesday evening, and she told me it's just been frustrating for now. So a lot of this sentiment that I heard from Elder's mother a little bit echoed the sentiment that the Guillen family manifested when her disappearance and her search was still ongoing. So I think, you know, a lot of people are really seeing the parallels between both cases, especially happening at such a short amount of time from each other, and the fact that they are not the only soldiers that have been found dead at the base this year.
Let's talk about that, because what type of pattern, Nicole, are you seeing emerge, if any, given Guillen Fernandez, and you mentioned other soldiers who have either been harassed or found dead? Are we talking about soldiers who have experienced sexual assault? Are we talking about soldiers who happen to be of color? Are there any patterns emerging right now that we can tell so far?
at least definitely a lot of them are people of color. Actually, Elder Fernandez's disappearance came exactly 1 year after soldier Gregory Weddle Morales was reported missing last year, and his remains were found in June as Vanessa Guillen's search was still ongoing. About not even a month after Weddle Morales' remains were found, another soldier, Melchor Morta, was found unresponsive in July around the same area where Weddle Morales' remains were found. And we have another soldier, Francisco Gilberto Hernandez Vargas, whose body was also found on August 2nd near a lake that's around the base area. So, I mean, just all these reports have really triggered Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy to say, listen, we have to order an independent review to see if the command climate at Fort Hood or anything, any kind of leadership failure had contributed somehow to all these disappearances and deaths at the base. And as part of that investigation, they're supposed to examine claims and historical data that have anything to do with discrimination, harassment, or even assault.
Nicole, are local law enforcement officials involved in any of these investigations, or because this is happening off of the base in the area of Fort Hood, I'm not sure if that means that this is solely the jurisdiction of Fort Hood officials and the Army, or if they are now involving local law enforcement officials?
Local law enforcement officials have been involved in these cases, especially since a lot of them seem to happen in the Killen area, which is the city right outside the Fort base, Fort Hood base. We also have Temple police right now, given the body that was found overnight, and they're trying to confirm that whether it is Elder Fernandez's body or not. So yes, but the catch is that normally the Army is the one that takes charge of these investigations, even though other agencies may be involved. I remember with Vanessa Guillen's case, even the FBI was involved, and the family was looking to have the FBI sort of take over in terms of being in charge of the investigation, even though they were already involved. So long story short, yes, other agencies are involved, but normally the Army takes charge.
Nicole Acevedo is a digital reporter for NBC News. Nicole, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you, Tanzina.
That's all for us today. We appreciate you listening. You can give us a call about anything at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.